Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections. Join them in the Ivy League of cheese education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, I'm the host. It's our 14th year, and for the first time, we get to be at the Craft Malt Conference in Portland, Maine. And I'm sitting with three maltsters, who I only just met yesterday, and they're going to introduce themselves, and we're going to have a conversation about malt and maltsters and all things good that makes your beer and spirits best. Okay, so let's go around the room. I'm Jimmy Carboni, I'm the host on Beer Sessions Radio.
My name is Jordan Ulrich. I am with Epiphany Craft Malt in Durham, North Carolina.
I'm Joe Hamill. I'm with Redshed Malting up in Red Deer, Alberta, Canada.
And I'm Jeff Bloom. I founded Murphy & Rude Malting Company in Charlottesville, Virginia.
All right, so first we're going to talk about the Craft Malt Conference and what it is. You know, as most of you probably know that, you know, barley malted is the base of beer, and other than water, it's really what all beer depends on. And these guys are going to tell you more about that. But, you know, over the last couple of years, through the Craft Maltsters Guild, I've got to interview quite a few really good people from the world of malt and grains. And this is like the all-star world of malt, you know. So if you want to make good beer or spirits, you got to get to know some of these people. So we're going to start. Everyone's just going to introduce themselves a little bit about what they've done. And what, as I'm always interested, I'm interested in people's jobs and how they got into the industry. So, Jordan, start with you, because I picked you as the all-star from the minute I heard you talking yesterday.
So, I have been malting for about 7 years now. I started off in Asheville, North Carolina at Riverbend Malt House before I moved on to Epiphany. I pretty much run the show at Epiphany. Sebastian, the owner and founder, has kind of given me the reins, which has been really great. He's been a great mentor, and I really enjoy working with him. I have a degree in agriculture, which is how I got into malting, working with the barley breeders at Virginia Tech. So I am very fortunate to still have connections and work with them to this day.
Wow, that's great. What was your first job in the industry?
Working as the lab specialist at Riverbend Malt. Yep.
That's good. So you weren't cleaning kegs?
No, I was not cleaning kegs. I was raking malt instead.
I like this malt crowd. It's a little cool. And now Joe, I met yesterday because he's from Canada, and everyone here from Canada kind of cannot forget.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So we're up in Canada, have a grain farm, and added a malt house to it about 8 years ago. So we specialize in roasted products. That's probably half of our sales are roasted malts, and then the rest are kind of high kiln and a little bit of base.
What's the difference between roasted malts and other malts?
So our roasted malts, they're going to add a lot more flavor and color to the beers. So they're used in a lot smaller proportions in the recipes and distilled spirits, but we're hour away from a couple of the big malt houses. So that's why we decided to focus on the specialty malts in our business.
Great. That's a great intro. Thanks. And Jeff, everyone's been telling me I should talk to you.
I don't know why, but here I am. So I founded Murphy & Rude Malting in 2017, went into production in 2018. Prior to that, I was malting in my basement, so I'm essentially a self-taught guru, if you will. I come from a corporate business development, bid capture management background. I fell in love with the agriculture behind malting before I fell in love with malting, to be honest. And what's interesting about that is that I have no agricultural background. My parents don't own a farm. I've never worked on a farm. I think they're great. But it's not necessarily the most linear story of how I ended up here. I think what it really ended up being is realizing what it takes to get grain not only in the ground and grown successfully, but then moved and malted and brewed all within very tight quality specs. And so it was just very, it was captivating to really kind of dig into this. And then like Joe, we actually did build with a focus on specialty malts, knowing we really didn't have the capacity that we needed to compete at the, you know, commodity pricing that we knew was going to be demanded. And go figure, it's about 65% of our business is base malt. So, I mean, I really nailed it on the business model, piece, despite the fact that I vetted it with as many people as I could, which is another good tip to potential business owners. What your potential customers say and actually do are oftentimes very different.
So it's like the old thing. It's like, let the numbers tell you what to do, right? Wow. And Joe's laughing over there.
Well, yeah, it's true. Like you come up with a plan and you're going to focus on something, and then, yeah, the customers kind of drive you in a different direction sometimes. And yeah, it's fun.
So like that first moment, starting with Jordan, when did you know that malt was your thing?
Oh man. So in grad school, I studied barley breeding, and I did not know what I wanted to do. All I knew is that I wanted to work in the beer industry. And I was like, how can I make this work? Like, how do I get in? And my mentor, Wincy Brooks, he hooked me up with Riverbend Malt, and I kind of started with them. And I was like, wow, I can actually use my degree and get into the brewing industry. So that's kind of how I got hooked on it. And once I started working for them, I was like, oh, I really love this. I get to work out in the fields. I get to work with the barley. There's a real connection between the farmers and the malt house. And then through that, the brewers. And I really liked doing all of that. So that's how I kind of figured that with malt.
All right. Joe. Yeah. So I started home brewing and being on the farm, growing barley already, wanted to naturally use my own grains in my own beer. So started doing some research and looking into it, talking with my brother, and he took it a little bit further and started a business plan. And then, we just went head first in and started malting. And I always wanted to come back to the farm. I was working off farm before, and this was one way we could diversify the farm and bring in some more incomes to get me back. So, yeah.
Great. And Jeff, your moment?
My moment was really a moment of curiosity. I mean, back in 2012, 2013, I believe, Virginia changed their brewery laws, which allowed breweries to sell their beer on premise out of their own location, as opposed to just providing samples so then people would go to the store and buy it at the store through distribution. So that changed the brewery model landscape in Virginia. About pretty much instantly, the number of breweries doubled and then doubled again and then doubled again. And there was a curiosity moment with a buddy of mine. We were at a brewery having a pint, and I was curious who the geniuses were that were in the supply chain behind this booming craft beverage industry. I mean, it wasn't only beer. I mean, even distilleries had been doubling overnight, despite their law still being quite tight. So I went, you know, I went home and I wanted to find who these people were, because I thought it would be a brilliant business decision, and I could not find anybody to save my life. And so I just kept looking. I'm like, there's just no way that there's nobody out there. And it was through my endless Google searching, convinced that there was somebody out there that I was missing, that I kind of fell into the agriculture behind malting. And, you know, the "where are these people" question kind of left my mind completely. And I really got into, you know, the breeding programs, the malting specs, you know, why you pick specific varieties, what's important about those specific varieties, how we malt them to maximize their functionality and their flavor, and then what breweries are looking at and distilleries are looking at. And, you know, it just completely took over my mind. And there was a bit of a blackout period there. I had just had my wife and I had just had our first son. At some point I built like a 200-pound system in my basement. I could not begin to tell you what was
Jordan's cracking up
vision. I think it was sleep deprivation, frankly. But I remember sitting in my basement and going, you know, it's 3 a.m. and I am like watching grass grow right now. I mean, this is really something. And I just never would have pictured myself there. But, you know, the Craft Maltsters Guild had just essentially been established. And I think there was about 12 of us at the time. I joined and just kind of trolled the Craft Maltsters Guild forum, watched everybody stub their toes so I didn't have to. And I think I got just so interested in seeing if I could pull this off is when I built that little system in my basement. And so, and here I am. I mean, it was really kind of just developed on its own. There was really no intention of me saying, I want out of this really great paying corporate gig, where I work from home and make DC money and, open a malting business and, you know, financially struggle for a few years. I mean, there was just never one of those. There's just never one of those moments. So, but here I am, and I couldn't be happier. And some things happen for a reason, I suppose.
All right. So, just in your career, again, just trying to spotlight you, because you're all three, and we're gonna go pretty deep with both of you. A moment, you know, in your mid career that stands out for you, something you're proud of, or something that challenged you to grow.
I guess for me, it would be when Sebastian brought me on to Epiphany. He really wanted me to take over the malt house and run the production and plan it and make sure everything was happening when it needed to and that the batches were going as they should. And I did, that was not responsibility I'd had before. And so for me, I was like, oh man, I really got to step up. I got to really learn all these new things. You know, apply all the knowledge that I've learned, and he's been great about it. I mean, he's there when I need him to be. If I have questions or if I'm doubting myself, he's always there saying, no, you got this, you know it, just trust your gut. And so that's been really great for me. I really enjoy it, and I'm really happy and proud that I have stuck with it. And yeah, I'm excited to see where it goes.
And then, and now the pick a malt that you make. And is there a brewery or a distillery that you're really proud of that's working with your malt?
Oh, there's many, but I mean, the one that stands out the most is Wooden Robot in Charlotte, North Carolina. They are there through us through almost everything. Like, they help us R&D products. They're the ones we go to if we have an idea. You know, they're one of our biggest supporters. I mean, those guys are great. So they buy a lot of our base malt and a bunch of our specialty, but I guess our modern Pilsner, our Pilsner malt is probably one of my favorites. It's just a good malt.
That's great. You're smiling too. I know you're proud of your work, and you have a real professionalism in your awe as you walk around here. And Joe, the same for you. Mid career, you know, you at your farm, you're malting. A moment, something you're proud of.
I think it's when you finally get to taste some of those whiskeys that have been aging for so long, that have used all your product. And once you taste that, you're like, wow, this is something. And, yeah, I don't know. It's just kind of playing on the roaster, developing new products, and then seeing what brewers want and tweaking the recipes and then seeing what they're doing with these products and yeah, I don't know. It's just fun seeing what the customers are creating with your product and getting out to taste it and chat with them about it and adapt to their needs. Yeah.
So is there one whiskey or distillery that you want to tell us about?
Well, there's one beer or brewery we work with every year for one beer they do. So they have some friends that grow the barley using all old equipment pulled by horses. So they plant it, plow it with horses, and harvest it. This year they ran it through a thrashing machine even. So we bring that in, custom malt it for them, and then we do three or four different roasts for them on that beer. And then they do it's a stock ale or brown ale that they make. And then they take some of that and then barrel age it and then put some bread in with it, and that's a pretty good product. Yeah.
What's the name of the brewery?
So that's Blind Man Brewing in Lacombe, Alberta. Yeah.
Wow. That sounds cool. Is that like a 19th century kind of recipe or fantasy?
Yeah. So they're just kind of, because they're using all these historical equipment, they kind of wanted to go back to a historical beer style and kind of bring it full circle. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds kind of cool, putting like leftover bread in.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. Yeah,
and for you, Jeff, mid career mode, you had the baby, you okay. Opened the store.
Now, so, yeah. So I guess
do you ever test the your hot steep on your kids?
We do for sure.
Oh, yeah. I've tried. Yes, my two boys are a bit stubborn still, so I'll get them eventually.
When ours come into the malt house, they go straight to the malt samples and just start yeah. chewing. Yeah.
They stop at mine tend to stop at the chocolate malts. I can't imagine why. So I suppose my pride moment is when we work with customers that are they're hesitant. They don't know really what to expect. And they finally make the decision, and seeing them take so much pride in how it improved what they were trying to do, it's pretty gratifying to know that your work is actually respected and reflected in products that people can consume, and when you can tell that your particular products are in a particular beer or spirit and you love it. It's a testament to continuing to get up in the morning. And we just get a chance to work with just some really intentional, ethos driven, producers. I mean, everywhere from Spear Lab Distilling, in downtown Charlottesville. I mean, he's very, very small batch, single malt whiskey producer on a Solera system. Just the most unassuming, master at his craft, that I've really met in the distilling world. His ability to make cuts is quite, impressive, but then, everywhere from, Wheatland Spring in, Waterford, Virginia, Black Narrows out in Chincoteague Island on the eastern shore of Virginia, Crooked Run in Northern Virginia. I mean, we work with these folks that really have so much purpose, and to be able to help them deliver on the purpose is special.
Yeah, we know Crooked Run. He's been on the show a few times, but someone else had said, ask Jeff about Wheatland Springs. So tell us what Wheatland Springs is. I don't even know what it is.
Well, and Jordan can speak to Wheatland as well. I mean, my relationship with the branding started really before I think the business did. John had called me up, and it was just another one of these conversations of, hey, I'm gonna start this brewery. I'm gonna grow the grain on the farm, and I'd like you to malt it. I'm like, yeah, okay, like sure. Frankly, expecting never to talk to him again because it's happened before. And they totally delivered on their plan. And so they grow estate grain. They send it down to us. We custom malt their estate grain. And then they also work with us, Epiphany, and other craft maltsters, you know, throughout the country, frankly, everywhere from Mecca Grade in Oregon to Hudson Valley in New York, and really kind of spreading the craft malt message. And they have just been huge champions of craft malt, as have, you know, the McKinnon Leonards of Crooked Run and the Josh Chapmans of Black Narrows and so many others. And so the work that they depend on us for is, it's gratifying to see how well received they've been, not only in Virginia, but nationwide. I think it, you know, it's a peer driven industry. And so when producers of that caliber are making high quality stuff with your stuff, their friends tend to follow suit. It's like I did when I first opened. I mean, reputation management was everything in year one. And it's because you can do as many sales calls as you want, but you can skip all of the sales calls if one customer talks to their friend and tells them what a good experience with your stuff. So it's just, you know, I love getting up in the morning and going to work because I get to, you know, help deliver on some of these goals.
Jordan, tell me more about Wheatland Springs. I didn't even know what it was until today.
Well, I think Jeff did a pretty good job summing up John's mission and what they do. I mean, it's pretty great. I mean, he helps do research with Virginia Tech on their experimental lines to test the different regions of Virginia and really make sure the varieties are suited to growing in that area. I mean, John's very passionate about what he does, and that's really great to be able to work with him and have him spread the message of using craft malt and its importance in the brewing world and distilling world. So
that's great. I want to talk about regionalism just because it seems to be important for everything from what you choose to grow to what people actually want to drink. You guys in particular, Virginia and North Carolina, for you in terms of the growing, are these the same regions or are they separate? And then what barleys or other grains are you guys working with? Want to go first, Jordan? Or
I would consider us the same region. Yeah, I would consider us the same region. Yeah, I mean, we're I guess, slightly north in the Mid-Atlantic, but we share a border. I mean, the growing season may differ just slightly, but generally the same varieties, working with the same ag universities to kind of triangulate varieties and adaptation to our regions. So it's nice to have good neighbors.
Yeah, so I heard about a new variety of barley that's coming out of Virginia. And that's why they said you got to talk to Jeff about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild to be in the moment that was, you know, 10, 12 years in the making. You know, I think the thing about regionality for us in the Mid-Atlantic is that nobody thinks we can grow grain over here. I mean, it's, you know, it's funny. I think it's, you know, it's a bit ignorant, but it actually was true for a minute there until people started investigating whether it was actually possible or not. And so that's where ag universities come in, Virginia Tech, NC State, you know, Penn State, Michigan State, Cornell. I mean, there's lists and lists and lists that bring varieties in and see if they will grow in our particular region. I mean, we are often growing European-derived varieties. I mean, don't look now, but I mean, our weather's kind of similar. And so we have gone from really no two-row malting quality varieties to a pretty robust pipeline of 4 to 5. And now we have one of our own. And it's just nuts. I mean, this stuff takes...
What is it? There's the name of this new barley. Yeah. Say it and tell us a little about it, because you're way ahead of everyone here.
So Avalon is the new two-row malting quality barley that was developed by Virginia Tech to grow in our region, in our climate. It is named after the street of the farm of that was owned by essentially the godfather of malting grain in Virginia. The one, Billy Dawson, the one guy that just took a bet and or took a risk on growing malting quality grain instead of corn and soybeans, and was really the one that trailblazed accessibility to, you know, grain at scale that we can grow regionally. And so his farm was on a road called Avalon. And so that they named, this new variety after, and he unexpectedly passed away, a few years ago. And so it's just a testament to his work, but, it's amazing stuff. It loves to grow here. It's got great characteristics. The way it malts is phenomenal. The results we get are phenomenal. And so I would say Virginia Tech nailed it on this one.
And Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, we're very excited about Avalon. We contracted some for this upcoming year to malt. It's really exciting to be able to malt it and work with it, especially with Billy's story. I know that he's helped a lot of our farmers in the area when no one else would. Billy would step up and he'd be like, yeah, I'll help you get some seed. I'll give you some recommendations. And he did it on his own time. He really just wanted it to succeed in the area. And now this farmer, local to us, Tim Cools, he pays it forward with other farmers. He's like, Billy did this for me and I want to continue that legacy. It's really important. So I'm really happy that they dedicated it to Billy and that this line is doing so well. And I'm hoping that a lot of people grow it.
And then if, so you're rolling out a new line of barley, what's the timing and the steps involved, you know, from seeds to farmers before it gets to you guys in the malt house?
Well, you gotta breed it first, which as Jeff said, it takes a long time to do that. It's like 12 years in the making. And then you gotta increase it and get that distributed out. And that takes time. And then it starts going out in smaller and smaller bases. And then eventually it's available for almost anyone that would like it. So once that happens, any of our farmers that wants to grow it, we're like, cool, we'll hook you up with our seed distributor and go ahead and grow some. And then we'll do field inspections. We'll let them send us harvest samples. We'll get it sent out for analysis to make sure it meets all of our specs. And we go from there. And then we start doing testing trials. Once we get it in, we'll malt maybe 5 or 10 pounds, kind of see how it behaves, because every year it's different. And go from there, do sensory, really make sure it's going to meet our customers' needs before we commit to doing 10-ton batches of it.
So. Jeff, anything else about Avalon? And also, like, I want to know who's using it and what beers are being made with it.
Not many yet. I mean, this year was the first year that commercial seed was available. So it has essentially proceeded out of foundation seed status where, you know, as Jordan mentioned, seed increases. So we essentially need to build up the seed stock so that we have have enough to be distributed. And so the first commercial planting of Avalon occurred in October of last year. And so we did get, you know, some sneak peeks at it with some surplus foundation seed that some growers had available. But so I think we all got a small taste of it. But this upcoming spring is going to be the first full harvest of Avalon. And so I think what is so exciting about it is that, you know, as a maltster, you kind of get to know barley varieties almost like, I mean, they each have like their own personality. They all act differently. They want different temperatures. They take up water differently. They obviously throw different flavor attributes. But, I never thought anything. I love Violetta so much, which is a European variety that has been very successful in our region. And Avalon is just a calmer, cool and collected version of Violetta, which I mean, if there was any dig against Violetta, it's that it can get a little intense. In day two of germination, we call it liftoff. It, over a course of 8 hours, it goes from, really calm to completely, completely crazy in the germination room. So, being able to kind of temper that, with Avalon is, it's the greatest, and we get equally good functionality out of it as we do with Violetta. So, I don't have any dings against it yet, at least.
Yeah, we haven't done too much with it yet. This will be our first year receiving it on mass scale. We've gotten very small samples, like I had said, but nothing large. So we're real excited to work with it.
Well, I'll say that make a cheers and a toast, Ching Chin. Big toast to Avalon, the new barley variety by Virginia Tech, right? Yep. Okay. Hey, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections.
It feels like a gift to be able to give this gift to people, because I know that from my own experiences, I know how valuable, consolidated, incredible training resources are.
They offer an in-depth education on all things cheese, as well as an active network for peer support and career development.
You can pop over to the Quad, which is our social networking and engagement app. And so that's a really fun and dynamic aspect of Cheese State University.
Cheese State's three-part course is designed for seasoned pros and entry-level mongers alike, and covers all the skills one needs to perform on the cheese counter.
The structure of Cheese State University is all based on the Cheese State University Field Guide. And that is a three-volume resource. It's all digital, online.
At the end of the course, students will be ready to ace the field guide assessment and earn their Cheese State Scholar Certificate.
Another resource is a video series where we tackle sort of like these thornier questions that you can get on the cheese counter, like what is rennet and like why is this cheese so expensive and can pregnant people even eat cheese?
At Cheese State, you're among experts, you're amongst scholars, you're among cheese lovers, and most importantly, you are a monger. Join them in the Ivy League of Cheese Education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, the host on Beer Sessions Radio. It's our 14th year with Heritage Radio Network. You can join us and become a member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. So we're here at the first in a long time craft malt conference in Portland, Maine, and I'm with three maltsters. One from North Carolina, one from Alberta, Canada, and one from Virginia. And we're just kind of talking, maltsters 101 for people like me that love our beer. Joe's here from Alberta, his family farm, and is also a maltster. We talked a little about regionalism. Tell us about Alberta, Canada, what's different there, what barley you're growing, and any other exciting news coming from the farm.
Yeah, we're pretty fortunate where we are for having a malt plant. It's one of the main regions in North America for growing barley. So we got two or three different varieties we're kind of working with right now. We're growing Churchill, Low, and Connect. So we kind of target them all to different end user customers. But yeah, they're all the big maltsters around us using them too. So, and we got breeding facility about half hour from us. And then there's another one in Saskatchewan and Manitoba as well. So, they're always pumping out new varieties. And so we were lucky being that close to some of the breeders that we can kind of get a sneak peek on some of them, especially with our batch size. You can kind of sneak them in before some of the big guys and get a preview on what's coming down the pipeline.
So, I mean, my understanding that in Canada, there's really big farms. There's a lot of malt. I remember Aaron from Hartwick used to tell us about the giant full trains of loads of grain coming out of that area. What is it like being a craft maltster in this big area? Do you feel like you stand out and you're adding something that no one else is doing?
Well, yeah, for us, it's interesting being right in the middle of the two big guys, competing against them. So the way we stand out is we got the roaster. So we're roasting half our products, and that kind of lets these brewers and distillers stand out, because now they have an option to do 100% Canadian grains, to get any kind of beer style or whiskey, made now. They don't have to import some of these roasted products from the States or from Europe.
That's great. Now a question just about the conference, because we're here at the Craft Malt Conference. For each of you, you know, what's a highlight of the conference for you? Jordan's ready.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty easy. I get to see my friends in the industry that I don't get to see very often. People come from all over the world to this conference to learn, network, and see their friends. So that's really my highlight, is just getting to see everybody, meeting new people. I mean, I don't get to see Jeff very often, and he's not even that far from me. So, I mean, that's really what the highlight is, and also learning. I mean, that's always a plus, but really it's just networking and troubleshooting and meeting new people.
Because you work all the time.
Yeah, I do work a lot.
Great. And Joe?
Yeah, I'd have to agree. It's just networking and seeing all these people that we haven't seen in years, sitting down, having a beer, having conversations like this. And I like it, whenever I get a chance to go see another malt house, you got to take advantage. So it's fun to head up to Blue Ox and check out his facility up there. And yeah.
And is there something that you learned from that visit?
Well, yeah, it's kind of always interesting just seeing how other people take their approach to malting. So yeah, it's kind of neat seeing how they set up their steep tanks and kiln, and then you can kind of take that back home and see if there's anything you can change at in your process and adapt or improve.
That's great. And Jeff, any specific highlight, something that you learned from this or a favorite session so far?
I mean, I certainly have favorite sessions. I mean, I think the coming American single malt whiskey movement is pretty exciting, and it's a huge opportunity for craft maltsters. I mean, this is obviously a big thing in the spirits world, but the ability to contribute to, you know, a new category of spirit is pretty exciting. And I have to say, you know, I love seeing everybody when I come to the conference. But one thing I kind of unexpectedly get out of this every year, despite the fact that it's taken us 2 years to get here, is it just gives me a good kick in the pants. You know, I think we can all kind of get stuck in the monotony and the grind of, you know, owning and operating malt houses and being the salesman, the manufacturer, and the janitor all at the same time. And, you know, I always leave here wanting to do better. And so it forces you to really, you know, take inventory and kind of audit what you're doing with your business. And I think it's just a great motivator in the end. And I think that's certainly a part of seeing your friends and your colleagues is certainly a part of that, but it just gives you time to, you know, like reflect, as opposed to you know, going into the malt house every day and trying to pump it out as fast as you can. So I certainly wasn't expecting it, but I love that.
No, there's a really nice mix here. There's farmers and there's maltsters. There's a few distillers and brewers, especially like Allagash, because they're kind of co-hosting. But it's been very eye-opening for me and enjoyable. You know, I'm slightly an outsider, but I feel like we're all, if you like beer and you like spirits, you're invested in good malt. And that's an important part of this conference. One question. So the keynote speaker, Rob Arnold, he talks a lot about terroir and flavor. Who wants to tackle that question? Or does terroir, I don't know, what is the relationship between terroir and flavor? I couldn't quite understand what he was talking about, other than he wants people to know that terroir can influence flavor. Anyone want that one? Jeff gets it. Thanks, Jordan.
Is this because I talk too much? Is that why you guys pointed it? I guess to answer your question, what's the difference between terroir and flavor? I mean, you know, terroir comes from the winemaking industry and the, you know, the effect of the region on the agricultural product. So, you know, the fact that barley is grown in Virginia as opposed to Colorado, you know, Virginia breweries using Virginia malt are inherently delivering Virginia flavor. I mean, we call our Pilsner malt Virginia Pils because it is, you know, that is what we are trying to do. We're trying to give the best example of what Virginia malt tastes like, you know, not encumbered by, you know, high kilning or, you know, other, you know, roasting or other or flavor at, you know, flavor additives, if you will, or techniques. It is just Virginia barley in a functional, flavorful package. You know, that's really what terroir is. I think the terroir question is a tough one because beer, particularly craft beer, is very loud flavor wise. You know, let's not even get into the like quadruple dry hopped, you know, with eight different hop varieties. Would it, you know, is it possible to notice the difference between Calypso barley and Violetta barley in a beer like that? No. I mean, this is my personal opinion. I will say no, there's just too much going on. If you do a smash beer, a single malt, single hop, I think you're getting closer. I think the biggest opportunity for terroir expression and regionality and flavor and regionality is the renewal of the appreciation of lager brewing in North America. I mean, I think there's a quote out there. I don't know why everybody's so surprised. You know, lager's been has been at the top for 500 years, and I guess we're just noticing. Lager, particularly pale lager, is just, you know, it's simple. It's simple. And that, I think, is the best vehicle for delivering regional flavor. But, you know, it's also a subjective topic. I mean, sensory is hard to begin with. And so whether somebody will pick up a flavor attribute between varieties or from different regions of the country is, you know, 50-50 shot, I guess. I mean, some people may pick that up and some people have very well developed palates probably can. So I guess that would be my answer.
That's a good one. And I'll say my takeaway from this whole conference is my own new tagline is talk malt, drink lager. And now that I'm talking to you guys, I realize that the history of modern beer really is the history of malting, right? I mean, it went from more of open flames and smokiness or funkiness to some more like temperature controls, you know, maybe starting in 1820 or something.
Yes, yeah, science helped a lot. I mean, the ability to analyze malt products and beer products, I mean, I think did great things for beer and spirits. I mean, decoction is a thing because maltsters had no idea what they were making back then. And it turns out it was not particularly thoroughly done. And so decoction, mashing, it was essentially the brewer extending the malting process. So I think that has really helped. The advent of science is a big turning point in, I think, beer's history.
So we're talking about from this idea of controlled malting. Is that the term, controlled malting, versus like just having a various malted grains and being, you know, put in a brew like I'm only saying 1820 because someone told me that's when like thermometers and other things were really coming into use. And I know the history of like Czech Pilsner was like 1840s, but they had taken some of the English technology that could create, you know, pale malts. And some, there's something happened around 1820 to 1840 where the ability to control the kilning and end up with the pale malts instead of a dark or burnt or what other types of malts people were using. I don't think we even realize what type of malts people use before. I mean, have you guys ever experimented with just like rustic, you know, kilning or whatever? I mean,
we've gotten requests for, you know, what they call diastatic brown malt, which is,
and also I don't know any of the terms, so I'm not making sense. So your job is to make sense of what I'm talking about. Thank you.
So, you know, we've gotten requests for diastatic brown malt. I think, you know, probably everybody at this conference has probably gotten that request. It was essentially the malt of lore. There's really no such thing as diastatic brown malt. The only reason it was diastatic and brown is because a portion of it got burnt when it lit on fire, because they fired their kilns with hay or, you know, coal or coke or any other, or wood, any other combustible. So the advent of indirect fired kilns, you know, was an improvement. I think with the science thing, it's mostly that, you know, if maltsters back in those days knew that they were making under modified malt, they would modify it better, but they didn't know because they couldn't test what they had. Certificates of analysis are much more for maltsters than they are for brewers. I mean, we try to speak a common language and both understand them, but I totally geek out on lab results. I mean, it is like the it is the most enjoyable part of my work, and because it can tell you so much, and then you can pull levers in the malt house to improve or change the result. And so, but if you don't have the ability to analyze your finished product, you would have no idea what to change because you don't know what you've got. And so, you know, the controlled malting, that was, those are improvements in just the way that industrial processes have improved. But in terms of knowing what you're getting in lab results is equally as important.
Thank you. I feel better. So it's the indirect heat is part of that also in the kiln.
Yeah, that was a major, I don't know if you guys agree with me. There's like a major, you know, turning point, I think, with kilning. I mean, direct fire exposes, or, you know, exposing high moisture grain to combustible gases exposes it to a huge nitrosamine load, which are very cancerous. And so by removing the combustible gases and just applying the heat, you're not exposing your products to those combustible off gases. So, I mean, a significant turning point.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's the only reason we have those pale malts and pilsner malts now, is with the indirect kilns. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they just didn't know what they were getting. And now that we do, we can make the proper adjustments. So.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, when I first used to do any malt shows, there was always this like fantasy that you could have some burnt or smoked or some kind of malt just on a fire or something. But that's not the case, is it?
I don't really think so. I mean, that's just my opinion. I don't know how many customers that asked for those kinds of products. So we had a customer ask for some wind-blown malt, which was an adventure, which is basically it's malt that's dried in the sun instead of a kiln. So that makes a very unique flavor. It's very, I guess, grass. There's a lot of grass flavor notes. It's very vegetative, but it's used for a unique style of beer. I think they did a lager of some sorts, a historical lager. But yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot of customers asking for like a open fired malt. I do have folks ask for smoked malt, but that's a whole different ball game, where you can maybe get some of those flavors you're talking about without the cancerous elements to it.
So how do you make smoke malt now in our modern times?
So we cold smoke it, similar to like you would do with meat. We rehydrate the grain. We'll smoke pretty much any product we have on the shelf, which is pretty unique. I have some folks mixing and matching and things like that. And basically, I use our roaster as our cold smoker, which is kind of fun. And we do all different types of wood. You can bring your own. You can mix and match. I have a lot of customization with it, which is what I like best. So
talk about sensory. I literally, as you were talking smoking, I just have the smell of like smoke coming off a barbecue smoker. It just went through my brain. I love that. Joe, what about you? Any unusual requests or experiments you've done? Because I think sometimes people want to go to the weird side too.
Yeah. Like we get quite a few people, especially distillers, asking about smoked malts as well. So we're trying to figure out a way to do that for them now. But other than that, most of the requests are pretty standard. We do some custom roasts for some people if they want darker or lighter than what our standard malts are. But yeah, other than that, it's pretty straightforward. Yeah.
And then tell us one more time about the brewery that does the horse. Just the horse product. Walk us through that again. And then what did that taste like? Is there anything different about it?
So they farm, I can't remember, it's like 10 acres or so with horse-drawn equipment. And so we bring in that barley and just run it through pretty much a normal malting process, come out with a Pilsner malt in the end. And then, we roast some of that. Some into our biscuit, so you get some nice kind of bready, biscuity notes out of that. And then we get some chocolate malt in there as well for some color. And then we do roast some of the green malt in our roaster for that project. So you do get a little bit of crystallization in there and some sweetness that translates back into the beer. It's a great beer. It's nice kind of English brown ale. Nice nutty notes to it and nice creamy smooth finish.
Wow, this is great. This is our second show at the Craft Malt Conference in Portland, Maine, March 17th, 2023. I'm going to ask you guys at the end, I'm sure at least one of you has a question for someone else in the room. You know, pretend we're at the conference and you're asking someone a question. This is the time. Who wants to go first?
Well, I'm curious about the smoking in the roaster.
So we basically converted it as a smoker. We funnel the smoke in, and I close off my vents to kind of keep all of the smoke contained in with the malt, and we rehydrate it. So I add a lot of water to it, get it nice and wet, which helps trap the smoke in. And I do it based on whatever they want their smoke strength to be. Ours is very different than what you'd see from like the peat smoked. Like we're nowhere near that strong. We're pretty subtle in comparison. But I kind of like that because it gives it more of a character. It's more well-rounded. I feel like you can pick up different flavor notes. Like, when you do like maple or pecan or applewood, you're getting more sweet smoke versus like oak, which is a lot more persistent and a little bit more potent, no sweet elements at all. I do that. And when it's done and the strength is achieved and everything has burned out, basically, I open the vents up and I dry down the malt to our specifications. And from there, I do have to either do a cleaning cycle or make like a chocolate or something. Yeah, dark roast to get rid of the smoke because it kind of hangs out. So I might accidentally get smoked something else of whatever goes in the roaster. And so we don't want that. So, yeah.
That's a good one. Any other questions?
This question is this will be to Joe, but every maltster in this conference wants to demystify what the right size malt house is. I mean, nobody has the answer yet. I don't know if we ever will. But I was just curious with Red Shed, if, you know, how did you guys determine your size in line with the farming operation? Was it linked to how much grain you guys were producing, or, I mean, in my case, I built what I could afford, which was definitely not enough. But how did you guys come up with your volume?
So our first system was a two-ton salad in box. I'm not really sure how we picked that size, really. It's because we grow way more barley than we consume in the malt house right now. So we still sell malt barley to the big guys. So I think probably originally it was probably based on finances as well, what we could afford at the time and what we thought we would be able to sell. So then now we just did a big upgrade. So now we got a 10-ton drum system now that we're operating into. So we still, even with that, we still have access barley that we grow. So we can still grow into it, probably add a second drum, and then we'd probably be getting close to our capacity on what we grow. Then we'd have to go sourcing some more from neighbors.
I mean, I would venture to say that everybody here is in some form of expansion mode. We built our system based on what we thought we could sell. Certainly like any private capital investor, it's very hard to convince someone like that you can sell, 1,000 tons a year, when you haven't done it before. There's managing expectations, falsely based opinions sometimes, but, I think it's a testament to our work. I mean, we all built too small of malt houses. we're trying to catch up or keep up. There are big hitters at these conferences now. I mean, Dan Carey from Glarus is at the Craft Malt Conference. I mean, these are big names in brewing that are showing up and saying this stuff is worth looking into, right? And so, I'm glad it's not the other way around. I'm glad I didn't build too big of a malt house and have capacity problems now. But it is just such an elusive number to figure out, like, what the right size is and how to expand and so on and so forth.
Even with our expansion, we didn't know what size to do. We were debating going to 5-ton size batches or 10-ton, but eventually settled on the 10-ton, but not really sure why, but that's what we did again.
Jordan, just last things, young person coming up, wants to get into this industry, what do you recommend they do or study?
I guess in this industry, you have to be prepared to work hard and get dirty. it's a pretty hard job. So I think the people who make it through are really dedicated and really love what they do. Otherwise, I think they decide to go down a different path. I would suggest maybe contacting a local malt house and asking if you could intern or shadow or, work for them a little bit, just to kind of get a taste to see if it's the right industry for you. It's really about who you know, and it's all about making the connections and into getting into this industry, because it is a very tight industry to get into depending on where you are. I just suggest that, go talk to your local monsters, see what they're up to.
You guys, this has been so great. I got Jordan, Joe, and Jeff, three monsters. This is a little snapshot of the Craft Malt Conference here in Portland, Maine, March 17th, 2023. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Good stuff. Jeff's got something. I love this.
I have one clarification to make. So when we were talking about, indirect or direct fired kilns, it was a very important improvement. There is something to be said for the historical significance of how malt used to be dried back in the day. I mean, for instance, Norwegian farmhouse brewing still relies on Sainhouse malt production, where they're drying, they're firing their kilns with heat underneath a wood floor that has perforations driven into it. I think what's important to note about you know, the historical significance of direct fired kilns, if everyone were consuming beer every day with malt dried on direct fired kilns, we would have a problem. You know, the fact that there are some whiskeys made with direct fired kiln malts, or you know, small portions of malt bills using direct fired dried malts is, you know, is not a concern by any means. I mean, there is certainly you know, attributes of those malts that are beautiful. So I don't want to diminish what like Caleb's doing at Sugar Creek Malt House. I mean, I think it's really important work, and it really celebrates very important pieces of brewing history.
Wow, and you know, it's an exciting moment here. There's a lot of people outside. What's going on? Who wants to tell me about what's happening tonight? Because it's a big part of the conference. Then we'll sign off.
The Malt Cup is happening, so we got to find out. I think these are four categories this year, and so maltsters had an opportunity to submit malt samples for analytical judging and sensory panels. So we get to find out who the winners are.
Well, that's amazing. And when this podcast airs in March or April 2023, you're going to be able to find out who the winners of this year's Malt Cup are. Last year, we know that Hillary from Rabbit Hill was one of the top winners, and we have a lot of respect for her. And I know she's on the board of the Craft Maltsters Guild. So thank you guys so much once again, Joe, Jordan, and Jeff. It's been a long day. We had some good beers at Navari Res. I'm going to go back there and try to finish off either the Northwoods Dunkel Lager and maybe the Alligator 16 we were drinking before too. So thanks so much. Shout out to our engineer, Armin Spengen. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo! Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.